Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. It's time for some fascinating travels today on the show, and they're all in the name of art. We begin with things wondrous and humble in one of America's finest art museums. Then we'll open up a can of dreams and scale a treacherous mountain in shoes several sizes too large. And we wrap things up with a good case of the blues on the banks of a new river. Still life that'll really knock your socks off at Rinalda House, Big Shoes by Open Dream Ensemble, and the 2013 New River Blues Festival. They're all coming your way next after this news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and Rinalda House Museum of American Art presents the exhibition Things Wondrous and Humble, American Still Life, through December 8th in the Mary and Charlie Babcock Wing Gallery. Things Wondrous features some of the finest examples of still life, both traditional and some unexpected approaches, from collections all across North Carolina. I recently met with Rinalda House curator Allison Slaby at the museum for a delightful guided tour.
Still life, something familiar to many of us in the art world, still life paintings, certainly. How far back does it go? When did it begin?
Well, it really has a long tradition in the history of art, from wall paintings in Roman villas up to and through the Renaissance. And in the Renaissance, still life was usually part of a larger scene, usually a religious scene. And then the height of its popularity was really 17th century Holland, when you had this emerging middle class, and they were demanding pictures with engaging but accessible subjects that they could really use to decorate their homes. And, you know, still life is kind of the poor stepchild in the world of art history. It's on the hierarchy of art, it's the lowest rung on that ladder. It starts with pictures of heroic and noble deeds and religious art, and then steps down to portraiture and landscape, and then you've got still life at the very bottom. But it's always been very popular because it is accessible, and it also has this amazing kind of illusionistic aesthetic that viewers find really engaging. And then there are the hidden symbols, which you can kind of decode, and it gives you a whole other context for the meaning of the painting. So that's one of the reasons that we were attracted to this topic.
And what sorts of symbols were really common early on in the tradition?
Well, this tradition of using objects to communicate an idea is something that gets really solidified in 17th century Holland, when a flower, it's beautiful to look at, but it also symbolizes the brevity of life, because flowers fade and they droop. A candle, a burning candle, or a candle that's just been snuffed out, also symbolizes the brevity of life, because it can be snuffed out. There was a lot about the brevity of life, because life was brief in those days, quite honestly. A mirror might symbolize earthly vanity. Books, earthly knowledge. A flute or other musical instruments might symbolize sensual pleasure, because it's a visual reminder of your other senses, so the pleasure of listening to music. So when you study the art of 17th century Holland, you kind of become accustomed to, oh, I think that, you know, this candle is symbolizing that life is transient.
Things wondrous and humble. Could you speak to the wondrous nature of still life?
There are these incredible, beautiful explosion, profusions of fruits and flowers, which again have this hidden meaning of fruit can rot and flowers can fade. He was painting right after the Civil War, when people were very conscious of the loss of life. But in his wonderful painting of flowers, there's a little bird's nest with eggs at the bottom, and that reminds us of new life and hope for new life after the Civil War. And it, you know, it's not just the 19th century. We have amazing paintings by Audrey Flack and Ben Shonsight from the 1970s, which are also this kind of explosion of things and stuff, but done kind of tongue-in-cheek sense of humor about our current interest in materialism and consumerism. So they're very aware in the 20th century, when they're painting these kind of over-the-top profusions of things, that we do have complicated relationships with our possessions.
So much effort goes into curating these exhibits, and I know that The placement of every painting is considered and debated and worked through. What are you hoping the takeaway is from folks who'll be coming to see this exhibit?
That there is hidden meaning in every work of art that they'll see. That it may appear to be a simple arrangement of objects, but it could be the artist challenging himself with new forms or new styles, or trying to communicate an idea, or in some cases, constructing his own identity on the canvas. There's a wonderful still life by Gregory Gillespie, which includes a lot of masks, which I think was really about him concealing his own inner demons and some of the struggles that he was experiencing at the time. So there are numerous, just incredible stories to tell with these paintings. And I think that they're accessible because we all have things in our lives. We have stuff that we own that help to construct our own identities. So I think that there are just wonderful stories to tell with these paintings.
All right. Well, let's see both The Wondrous and The Humble downstairs. We're going to get ready for a gallery tour here at Rinalda House. And we're walking down the hallway on the way to the Babcock Wing through Rinalda House into the lovely lobby. The gallery is closed, but we get a sneak peek. And wow, this just really hits you when you walk in the door. Allison, tell me about this painting that greets us as we walk into the gallery.
The first painting that you see is Audrey Flack's Bounty from 1978, and it's this incredible pastiche of stuff. There's a burning candle, which of course references the brevity of life. There's a handheld mirror, which references vanity. So there are these clever art historical references, but then she combines them with this very kitschy plastic parrot and plastic grapes and carrots and cherries and a lemon that seems to just kind of float towards you. And all of these kind of strange, kitschy elements. But then at the bottom, there's a photograph of her daughter. So it's items that seem meaningless, items that are meaningful, items that are personally meaningful to her. I think ultimately it is about all of the stuff that makes up our lives.
There's a really dreamy quality about that, and the three-dimensionality of it is striking. Is there a particular style that you'd use to describe this?
This would be called photorealism. She was part of the photorealist movement, and she used an airbrush with acrylic paint to produce this very smooth day-glow surface. But interestingly, she then highlights the surface with these big blobs of white paint to pick up the kind of shininess of the plastic parrot. So you do see the hand of the artist as well.
Very contemporary looking, and yet painted in 1978. Bounty. Okay.
Let's head into Things Wondrous and Humble.
All right, here we go.
So this is our painting by Severin Rosen from Rinalda's collection, and most of the works in the exhibition are from our collection. And this is painted in about 1867, just after the Civil War. And it's just a profusion of flowers, all kinds of different flowers. It's really kind of a fantasy. These flowers couldn't all have been in bloom at the same time. So he's really creating this kind of ideal composition. And it is about kind of hope and optimism after the Civil War for new life. And he really brings that message home at the bottom with this little bird's nest that has three eggs in it. And the eggs really are about new life.
Beyond the symbolism, it's a beautiful work of art. The detail is incredible, and the variety of colors is just wonderful. Down to the tassels on the fabric on top of the table there. How was he known in his time? Was he revered or just another painter? Where did he fall in that spectrum?
Unfortunately, Rosen did have some struggles. He lived in Pennsylvania, and he was fond of beer and often paid his bar tab with paintings. So, so he is much more revered now than he was in the 19th century.
For those who go to the website and find out more about Things Wondrous and Humble, they'll recognize this painting.
This is by William Michael Harnett. It's called Job Lot Cheap, and I think we're definitely more on the humble end of the scale with this painting of really just a jumble of books placed on top of a crate. And this is what you would see maybe in a bookseller's shop. He's placed together this jumble of unrelated titles, and he's going to sell them cheaply. He's actually used the cover of a book to write a sign that he's going to sell this job lot, this jumble of unrelated titles, cheaply. And the reason that he needs to sell them cheaply is because the crate that they're resting on has a lot of just published books. So he's got to make space on his shelves for new books, and he's getting rid of these old unsold titles. But I really think that this painting is about the permanence of art, the permanence of the written word. They might be sold, but they'll continue to exist. And by extension, the permanence of Harnett's own painting, that it will continue to exist even as it changes hands.
I love the layout. It breathes so nicely. I feel like I can go one-on-one with all these paintings. Nicely laid out.
We really worked hard to select the best still lifes from our collection, but also from some really key collections across the state, the North Carolina Museum, the Weatherspoon, the Ackland, and really bring some treasures that enliven our own collection because we get to compare them to works from other collections as well.
Now, from the hyperrealism, this looks almost impressionistic.
Exactly. I think that you would call this still life adapted in an impressionist style. We are very lucky to have this painting from the Weatherspoon by John Singer Sargent, one of the masters of late 19th century, early 20th century painting. And he didn't often paint still lifes. He usually painted portraits, society portraits. But this is probably a little sketch that he did just in his own time, relaxing, sitting in a garden, a beautiful little, I think, Japanese-inspired painting of a vase with some blossoms in it and a very sketchily painted background. And it's just a very relaxed mode for Sargent.
I love the contrast here, but they all work together so well somehow. And this is, quite a contrast.
So in the exhibition, we have, I would say, three rather traditional fruit still lifes. And then you come to the next painting in the series, which is by Julie Heffernan from 1996. And it appears to be a traditional fruit still life until you realize that embedded in the individual pieces of fruit, there are these strange, surreal, somewhat disturbing scenes. There's a scene that looks like there are some kind of otherworldly figures fighting. There's a scene that looks like an almost film noir interrogation. And it's just a really intriguing, I would say, postmodern work of art. And Julie Heffernan is actually coming to speak on November 21st. And so I'm hoping that she'll clue us in as to the inspiration for this piece.
How do you find out about the inner workings of these paintings?
Well, in the case of this painting by Robert Gwathmey called Bell from 1965, we're fortunate to have the writings of the artist. So we do know what he was attempting to communicate with this work. It's a very complex image, multiple figures, multiple objects. I think one of the most recognizable, of course, is the cross that's held by the man on the right. But what's interesting about that figure is that he's holding two crosses, one in front of him and one behind him, which is in flames. And I think it's about hypocrisy, racism, and racist violence in the 1960s.
And are docents on hand to answer questions for this exhibit?
Docents will be giving tours from time to time. There are wonderful object labels written by our guest curator for this exhibition, Martha Severins, and they will clue you into the meaning of the objects.
And this is a feast for the eyes as well. And is this part of your collection? I've seen this before.
This is a painting by Gregory Gillespie called Studio Still Life from 1978, and it is part of our collection. I think it's an incredible work. Large scale, it's a still life, but also a self-portrait, the artist painting himself. And I think one of the intriguing things about the painting is there's a lot of sexual imagery. There are several masks in the painting, which I think communicate the idea of deceit, that he's concealing something, that he's probably concealing his own demons. He was a very troubled man.
I love the texture of the wallpaper. I mean, you feel like, again, you could just reach out and touch it. Is it raised such that there is actually a texture to it?
There is, but it's all paint.
Yeah, and I know there's some three-dimensional works in the exhibit as well, but that's about as close as you can get to three-dimensional art within this realm.
Exactly. There are some wonderful three-dimensional pieces that we'll take a look at around the corner.
We're on our way.
Mm-hmm. this piece by Elihu Vedder called Dancing Girl from 1871 is one of the works that we're using to challenge our visitors. What is a still life? Because you would look at this piece and think it's a portrait or a genre painting because it depicts a dancing girl. But the objects in the painting really tell the story. She's an entertainer. She has juggling balls and juggling sticks and a tambourine. And she can also tell your fortune. And it's the Wheel of Fortune down in the corner with the arrow pointing at the skull that communicates to the viewer that youth and beauty are fleeting, both for the dancing girl and for the viewer himself.
Some of these are very large panels. This is another large work, another feast for the eyes.
Yes, this piece from our collection by Ben Schonseit called English Town Jewels. Schonseit was another photorealist artist like Audrey Flack. He used photographs to create his paintings. So this is a huge painting of jewelry. And so you're trying to figure out what's it about. And the title is English Town Jewels, and it's referencing a flea market that he visited in New Jersey in 1971. So what appears to be precious at first is actually kind of worthless and junky.
When you say the use of a photograph, that tradition goes way back, using technology to enhance the process.
Right, back to the use of the camera obscura in the 17th century. And what's remarkable, I think, about this painting is that it does look like a photograph, but it is a painting. He uses the photograph to create the painting, but then he creates these tiny little brushstrokes using an airbrush and using acrylic paint, and it's so hyper-realist, it's absolutely dazzling.
And yet he takes it slightly out of focus. Interesting technique there.
Schonseit has a visual impairment, actually, which means that many of his works have a kind of out-of-focus, blurry quality to them.
How about that? All right. There is some whimsy here in the Babcock Wing.
There's a lot of whimsy. I think there are moments of great humor in this exhibition. With this piece, which is called Telephone from 2000 by Robert Lazzarini, which we borrowed from our friends at Wake Forest, the question that we're asking is when the object is an object and not an image of an object, is it a still life? So again, we're challenging our visitors. So this piece is, I think you would call it a sculpture, but it was produced in this absolutely fascinating way. He took a photograph of a kind of 1970s era avocado-colored telephone rotary dial, and then he scanned it, put it in his computer, and then distorted it digitally and used the distorted image to create this object out of plastic and rubber and metal and paper. And so it looks like a telephone that you've stretched out, and then it's mounted on the wall, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for this gallery tour.
Thanks, David. We're really looking forward to welcoming people here this fall.
Rinalda House curator Allison Slaby, Things Wondrous and Humble, American Still Life, continues through December. American Arts Discovery begins Tuesday, September 3rd at Rinalda, and continues Tuesdays and Thursdays through October 10th, from 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. The 12-session course uses an interdisciplinary approach to teach American art history through the museum's art collection and researching correlations in literature and music of the same time period. Cinema Under the Stars kicks off at Rinalda on Friday, August 30th at 9 p.m. with Back to the Future. You'll find links to all of this summer's screenings at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a short break right now. When we get back, get set for some kind of fun. It's Open Dream Ensemble, with four dancer, musician, playwright, actor, director types who all called UNC School of the Arts home at one point in their lives, and they're back wearing big shoes next after this short break. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and there's big-time blues coming your way later on in the show with King Bees live in Studio A. They're the real deal, and they're ready to sting and swing in just a bit. But first, Open Dream Ensemble is a project of the Thomas S. Keenan Institute for the Arts and an outreach program of UNC School of the Arts. They're now in their ninth season, fostering the creativity of artists and youth through the creation of original performances. Each year, Open Dream Ensemble touches the lives of thousands of students during arts-integrated residencies throughout our state. You can see for yourself Saturday, August 31st at 2 o'clock in the UNCSA DeMille Theater with a free and open-to-the-public performance of Big Shoes by playwright and performer Michaela Morton. She's joined in the studio by UNCSA BFA and directing graduate Wiley Basho Gorn, who plays the role of Gordy, clarinetist, dancer, performing artist, and educator Marissa Byers, trombonist, composer, and bandleader Cameron McManus, and Open Dream Ensemble artistic producer and general manager Rebecca Nussbaum.
Big Shoes is the story of a little boy named Gordy who very much wants to fill his older brother's shoes. So he sets off on an adventure after his brother, who is the big man on campus, has announced that there will be a Shackleton Club for great men of daring and fearless explorers, which will only include eighth grade boys, which will disinclude his younger brother, Gordy. Gordy decides that in order to prove his worth, he has to summit the mountaintop of Mount Blacklock. So he meets a range of kooky and wise, surprisingly wise characters on his way to finding out that it's better if your shoes fit you and better to be who you are. And there's music and adventure all along.
Is it true, Wiley? Is it better to wear your own shoes? Wait, tell me about Gordy. What kind of guy is this young man?
Gordy is completely in awe and in total admiration of his brother. He looks up to him so much. And I know from being a kid, you always want to play pretend. You want to be something that you're not. And I think one of the great beauties of growing up and becoming an adult is realizing that you are who you are and there are certain things you'll never be able to change. And that's okay. And I think Gordy starts to learn that lesson right towards the end when he really comes into his own.
All right. Can we hear a little snippet from the show?
Of course.
What could you lead us into this little read here?
Yes, this is right when Gordy has made the decision that he's going to go on this adventure to the top of Mount Blacklock. What should I pack? In case of attack? A piggy bank for food or change, and some jam if things get sticky, and maybe a piece of string, because that's what every explorer brings, although I can't seem to tie knots in anything except my stomach. Stop it! You're an adventurer, just like Alexander. Yes, you are, Gordy. Yes, you are. And even if you've got a stupid name or a stupid face, or even if you've got stupid small feet, just ridiculously tiny, but hey, hey, I'll bring my brother's shoes with me, huh? Alexander won't mind. Besides, they're probably going to be hand-me-downs to somebody. Why not me? I'm his brother, aren't I? Yeah, I'm Alexander's brother.
It must be fun to see your characters come alive just 3 feet away there, Michaela.
It is. And last year I was in the show, so actually, this is the first time I have ever seen it.
What's that dynamic like? I mean, being in the audience, you know, you can't control exactly what's going on at that moment. Is it tough to let go?
Not really, but I recognize that that answer is influenced by the kind of people that I'm surrounded with and that I've jumped into the midst of on this project, because I implicitly trust the people who are telling this story. So it has not been hard for me to take a step back, because I anticipate the joy of their discovering things that I didn't know existed in the story.
Striking how many instruments you all play, and in the case of Marissa, background in ballet, modern jazz, belly dance, you know, really serious clarinetist. And how do they all come together in Open Dream Ensemble?
I have to say it's been an amazing thing, both this year, I guess the past two seasons of Open Dream, to finally have one performance opportunity where I can utilize all these things that I can't help but do. They didn't ever really work together. I went to school for classical clarinet performance, got all my degrees in that, but I've always kind of danced on the side. Then when I was done with school, I went full force into different styles of dance, especially belly dancing, took me to India, and just like managed to continue doing all of them, thinking, oh, this is one of those jack-of-all-trades things. It's not going to go anywhere, and there's no place for it. And it's really neat to have something like this where I can, you know, I don't use all of them, but certainly we have choreography that Julianne has put together that just makes the show, just gives that extra flair. It makes it, you know, sparkly. And then this great new music that we have this year. Both our composers, Kenny and Bruce, have just written incredible stuff that I can really play. I mean, it's not just like whatever little melodies. It's music that I have to work on, and that is always satisfying for me.
Maybe I'll throw it Cameron's way. You've performed the role of Gordy now before, so you know this show inside and out. How's it been? And talk about that transition.
It's really amazing to be able to switch from one character to another, especially from Gordy to his older brother, Alexander. So I went from being that kid who just worshipped his older brother to now all of a sudden being that, you know, little very self-assured older brother who's just has it all going on, and he is the big man on campus, as Michaela said.
Could you put into words the kind of perspective it gives you flipping roles like that?
Well, I think I was much more Gordy in middle school than I was Alexander. So for me, it's being everything that I wish I could have been when I was that age. So I'm just having a great time. It's very fun for me.
And Marissa, tell me your role within the show. What are you going to be doing?
The clarinet is probably the thing that I'm doing the most, but the character that I really enjoy playing is, well, my name is Deepish, but I'm one of the triplets-ish. We have Deepish, Sheepish, and Weepish. And the three of us kind of have this Andrew's sisters act. And Deepish is funny. Well, last year I played Sheepish. And so I was one of the triplets, but a different one. And so last year I was speaking loudly and making myself embarrassed and blushing a lot. And this year Deepish is, well, I'm a know-it-all, but I'm Deepish. So I don't necessarily say the most profound things, but they sound like they might be. It's really fun. It's such a different approach that, you know, than what I took last year to be Sheepish. We get to sing this great song, like I said, Andrew's sister's style. And then I'll be dancing and I'll do a quick turn somewhere and then go grab my clarinet and play the hardest thing. Well, the show is playing when I'm out of breath. That was a real challenge. I've never had to do that before.
I can imagine. Your audience, per se, is going to be young folk for the most part in this. Talk about the age range and how these collaborations work with young people in the schools.
So this show is targeted fairly broadly for kindergarten through fifth grade. So we'll mainly take it to elementary schools, though there have been a few exceptions in the past year of touring where we went to community centers or people were coming in from a broader community in order to see the show. But typically what we do is if we're going to do a residency in the school, we'll bring the show in at the beginning of the week. We'll set it up very early in the morning. We'll perform for a group that includes K through 5. And then if we're going to stay there, say between 2 and 5 days, which is the typical length of an Open Dream residency, we're going to see those kids again in their classrooms. We'll be paired across disciplines and across genders so that last year when I was a member of the ensemble, my training is in drama. My partner was William, who is a jack of all strings, and his primary training is in classical guitar. And so after the show, we would go into classrooms and teach arts-integrated lessons to kids across that span of ages. And the lessons are designed to interact with the science curriculum in each grade and to introduce some basic concepts in a creative, dynamic, and arts-focused way so that the integration occurs at a very deep level.
Oh, Marissa, you kind of alluded to one way in which you're kind of stretching yourself artistically, going from dance to grabbing the clarinet. How about you, Cameron? Have you been involved in first off, any of the outreach activity, the residency programs?
Well, this is my second season with the Open Dream Ensemble. As Michaela said, we're paired up with people across genders and disciplines. So last year, I was able to bring my trombone into the classroom and integrate that with Haiti Thompson, who's a fantastic teacher, and her drama background. So we got together, came up with all kinds of great things, and were able to craft some lessons where we could really get the students to explore their own creativity in learning And that was really special to see them kind of take ownership of things and see them move through the learning process. As far as my own creativity goes, I predominantly have been a jazz performer, so I'm able to bring that into the show. William last year played guitar and upright bass. He is not with us this year, so I am playing guitar, something that I've picked up to varying degrees of success over the last month. So that's been really fun. I'm also playing saxophone, which I've been only working on for a year and a half. So there's that musically, I'm stretching myself. And I had never been in a play before working with the Open Dream Ensemble. So it's a whole different kind of performance. Really great to just get out on stage and think about what it means to portray a character to an audience in a way that I hadn't really explored before.
One of my favorite conversations that we've had with the kids in the course of our residencies and performances, and it's happened time and again, is a conversation about, like, how did you learn to do X, or how did you learn to do Y? Because usually they'll be asking somebody who has learned that skill very recently. In the course of Open Dream, we're all going to pick up new skills. And I think it's so valuable and exciting for the kids, and also for us to have the affirmation as adults who are at the beginning of creative learning in different disciplines, that it's okay to be a grown-up and be a beginner. It's okay to start again at the very root of something and be working it out, even in a public setting, and that that's something fun and valuable to do, because so often we associate being a beginner with being a kid. And being an adult with, like, having things figured out and doing the thing that you're expert in, rather than taking the risk of learning something new.
Well, I got to ask you, I mean, Rebecca, now that you're in your ninth season.
Yes.
I mean, you start off with a model, an idea of how you want Open Dream Ensemble to be, to function throughout the year. How's it evolved since then? What have you learned along the way? And where do you see it heading, you know, in the next 9 years?
Open Dream has evolved in a lot of ways in 9 years. But part of the reason why it's been almost forced to evolve is that education has changed. And standards within education, expectations within education have changed. So just by the nature of change that happens within schools, we've had to adjust how we work and how we make sure we're addressing what needs to be addressed in a classroom setting, for example.
And this goes beyond just the core curriculum. What else are we talking about?
Right. Part of it, of course, is the standards. You know, you have your essential standards and the Common Core, which came in just last year. So those are new for all the teachers in North Carolina because the state just adopted those. And certainly that has forced us to go back and reassess what we do. But another element of what we're trying to make sure we address in a classroom are these 21st century skills, which is something else that has been put on the lap of teachers all over the state, because the state has mandated that they're supposed to be using 21st century skills in their classroom so that the kids are ready to graduate and be productive citizens of the United States. But what often happens is when we go into a classroom, we're able to hit not just the standards, but in the arts, it's a natural fit for the 21st century skills. We are collaborative by nature. We are creative by nature. We think critically. You have to if you're going to be an artist. So those are things that we can bring children with ease, actually, bring them into those types of skills, as well as, you know, the revised Bloom's taxonomy, which is a whole nother part of education that's recently shifted over. So looking at the revised Bloom's and how those words are much more active now. Like, they're wanting students to really not just be able to memorize things and kind of know what they mean, but they're supposed to have a deep understanding. They're supposed to be able to analyze. They're supposed to be able to really create something out of the knowledge that they have. So those are all things that within our residency work, we try very hard to help the children along with and kind of give them some tools. I mean, that's one of the things for me that I think is wonderful about the arts, is that as artists, which is what Open Dream is made out of, we all have this wonderful toolbox that we can open up and say, hey, you know, okay, now we're going to use our bodies, we're going to use our voices, we're going to use instruments, we're going to use our minds, and we're going to use our imaginations. And when you start working with children with those different tools, what you see is a lot of learning happening and a lot of joy in a classroom where the kids aren't stuck sitting down to learn, but where they're actively involved in their learning. And that's part of the whole teaching artist training, which we spend about at least 40 hours doing. That's part of the whole structure of the program, is to equip the artists in Open Dream Ensemble with the tools that they already have. So basically, it's like showing them their toolbox and saying, okay, this is what you do with all these things that you already have. And go out there and create something great.
Playwright and performer Michaela Morton, UNCSA BFA and directing graduate Wiley Basho Gorn, who plays the role of Gordy, clarinetist, dancer, performing artist, and educator Marissa Byers, and trombonist, composer, and bandleader Cameron McManus. They were joined by Open Dream Ensemble artistic producer and general manager Rebecca Nussbaum. The Open Dream Ensemble production is Big Shoes, and the performance is Saturday, August 31st at 2 o'clock in the UNCSA DeMille Theater. It's free and open to the public. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And I know it's the weekend and all, but are you ready to sing the blues? Hope so, because when we get back from this little intermission, it'll be all blues all the time with guitarist Rob Hound Dog Baskerville and bass player, vocalist Penny Queen Bee Zamagni live in Studio A next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Say, got any holiday weekend plans yet? Well, how about dancing in a mountain meadow by a sparkling river to world-class music performed outdoors live by a host of blues legends? Well, thanks to the 11th annual New River Blues Festival, that little blues pipe dream can come true. You see, it's really here, Sunday, September 1st, at the River House Inn in beautiful Grassy Creek, North Carolina, on the shores of the New River. Gates open at noon, the music starts at 1, and it'll be performed live by a veritable who's who list of world-renowned blues artists, including Ironboard Sam, the Living Blues Most Outstanding Keyboard Player Award winner, legendary blues harp player Dr. Dixon, and Piedmont blues artist Big Ron Hunter. New River Blues Festival directors Penny Queen Bee Zamagni and Rob Hound Dog Baskerville are the King Bees. More than 25 years ago, Penny and Rob committed themselves to mastering this incredible art form, studying with and eventually touring the country with the likes of Bo Diddley, Carrie Bell, B.B. King, Nappy Brown, and many others. They shared this look at their early years on the Chitlin' Circuit, live in Studio A. What are we going to kick things off with here?
Let's do Sugar Papa.
Sugar Papa. It's a swing tune. It's somewhat traditional, but I've mixed in some other lyrics and made up a few of my own, and we've got a jumping little arrangement.
All right. Well, let's jump on in then with Sugar Papa. We've got Martin Henderson on drums,
yeah.
And Rob's going to be playing not only guitar, but a little organ for us on this one as well.
As yeah. I recall.
And Queen Bee's going to be on the bass and vocals. This is Sugar Papa, the King Bees here live in Studio A.
Sugar Papa, Sugar Papa, what makes your sugar so sweet? Sugar Papa, Sugar Papa, where do you get that good sugar from? Hey, yeah, sugar papa, where do you get that good sugar from? He was raised in Louisiana, way down on your mama's sugar farm. Well, they're bragging about your sugar, they're bragging all the time. Hey, they're bragging about your sugar, they're bragging all the time.
Studio
rest.
A. Yeah, we'd like to call it Studio B, but we've only got the one studio. So it's studio. But that's an awesome tune. I mean, I call that a showpiece for a vocalist. I mean, holy smokes, the growls, the nuance, the licks. I mean, are you a natural at this? Is this something that you just dived in and, oh, I can rip this stuff off? What's it take to do all that?
I don't really exactly know, but I know I started young, and in what I encourage all parents to tell their kids, get involved in band and chorus as soon as they are able to show any interest in music whatsoever, and that happened to me, and it probably kept me out of some trouble, not all trouble, but and I just did have to learn how to play bass and sing sympathetically, and it was tough at first, the bass playing and the singing, putting those together, but finally it all went, whoa, okay.
Is it click like that after years? Or
it took about a good year of feeling that I was never going to do it right, and then after that year, things fell into place for some reason.
Because I got to say, you're not just not a lot of pedal tones when you're singing. You're walking that bad boy and singing at the same time. That's just some great playing.
Always working on it. Always a project in progress.
Yeah. And then you're shifting from instrument to instrument now, Rob. What's the transition like going from the guitar solo right into the organ right away? And then is your approach to improvising on the organ any different than on your axe?
Yes, it's much more limited.
Well, okay. You convinced me.
Yeah. You know, my grandmother was a piano and an organ teacher, so that was my first instrument. And it's been a long, long time since I took lessons from it. But, you know, I listened to a lot of organ players over the years, and my dad would, of course, take me to see the Basie band. And so all of my ideas come from just a couple of places and the dynamics that, say, a big band like that use are always behind. When you have limited licks, you use a lot of creativity in other ways in arrangements and that kind of thing.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned Count Basie, the master of the minimalist approach to improv.
Yes, yeah.
Just a few notes say so much.
That's the idea.
Yeah. No, it sounded great. And you reminded me of the great thing about blues. I mean, the humor.
Thank you. Finally, someone says that, because you see all these blues bands in their promo picture. They're all going to have sunglasses and have their arms crossed and scowling. What are you scowling about? I mean, this music is great. It's fun.
Talking about humor, this next tune, I mean, I just love the name of this one. Everyone loves Ham Hock Stew. I know this is a bitter love song.
Well, there is a certain kind of blues that to me is a little bit pretentious. It's the Chardonnay. I won't mention the artist who does a lot of blues with that kind of sophisticated stuff going on. But let's get down to it. The real blues folks don't drink Chardonnay or eat filet mignon. They eat Boston Button. They eat Ham Hock Stew or whatever.
Right,
you know?
Right. We've seen this.
We've been around it.
Well, how did this tune come about, though, besides the reality, the earthiness of the stew? I hope it's not a true life story.
I love Penny's intro, which she often does live, which sort of explains a bit of what
that
you're asking.
The song may not be a true story, but I will say that I did write it, and that my husband can't cook a lick. So imagine how you would feel after a hard day of work when you walk in the door and the house smells like home cooking. And you know he doesn't cook. So what is your first emotion?
I'm not lying this time, baby.
Suspicion. You're suspicious. So that's what this song is about.
All right. Well, my appetite and my musical appetite has been whetted with that one. Let's sashay on over. We're in Studio A with the King Bees.
Thank you. got to throw away the boy. To throw away the bomb. I'm suspicious.
Oh man, I tell you, that is a great tune. I just gotta say, I mean, I just from the second you started, the first time you say she forgot to throw away the bone, I heard that line. I'm thinking, that is so perfect. That sounds like it's got to be a blues standard. When did you come up with that one? Just smile. I mean, tell me about
that. Well, you know, I just, you want it to have a slightly risque implication without being overt.
A little double entendre.
A little double entendre thing going on there. And so the wife, of course, is suspicious, and she has a clue. The bone is still there, you know. So
that is awesome. Who are some of your, in terms of the storytelling, though, Penny, female blues artists who tell a story like that with that wry wit, that sly smile? I mean, who are some that you look up to?
Well, of course, Bessie Smith had great songs with a lot of the double entendre and humor in them. And
I need a hot dog for my bun.
I know. That was just typical for that period of time, and it was so engaging. And, of course, she was a fabulous singer and always had great musicians. And then Memphis Minnie, who followed her, guitar player, which was interesting, always had a little bit of double entendre going. Won't you be my chauffeur and drive me all around town? And then Sonny Boy Williamson, Rice Miller, had great lyrics. He's probably my favorite of all lyricists in blues, and just led an incredibly kind of violent and weird life, but he had these songs that were so engaging and created characters that you really liked, and you really liked the persona that he expressed to you through the music and the humor that he expressed. So.
Yeah. Penny Queen Bee's Magni and Rob Hound Dog Baskerville, the King Bees. Rob was recently honored as a Blue Ridge Heritage Artist, and this fall the King Bees will perform at the Rhythm Riot Roots Music Festival in London. Meanwhile, on this side of the pond, Rob and Penny direct the New River Blues Festival, bringing the luminaries and lifeblood of blues to the heart of rural Appalachia. New River Blues 2013 is this Sunday, September 1st, at the Riverhouse Inn in beautiful Grassy Creek, North Carolina, on the shores of the New River. Gates open at noon, with live music from 1 to 6 performed by world-renowned blues masters. You'll find links to the complete performance lineup at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. It'll be 5 full hours of hot blues in the cool mountains. Advance tickets are $15, $18 at the door, and children under the age of 12 get in free.
Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And we would love to hear from you. Send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. In the meantime, you'll find podcasts and archive programs on our website, wfdd.org. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.